Hello and welcome to Spiritually Hungry. I'm so excited for our conversation today. Our guest is Lisa Bilyeu. She's the co-founder of Quest Nutrition, co-founder and president of Impact Theory, and the host of Women of Impact, a podcast where she interviews some of the most radical thinkers and successful business people today. And she is a friend. She's really such a great person. Her recent book, Radical Confidence, discusses big topics we love here at Spiritually Hungry, like not letting fear stop you and overcoming negative beliefs. So let's welcome Lisa. Hello and welcome to Spiritually Hungry. Today, I'd like to welcome my friend, the amazing Lisa Bilyeu. Super excited to have you on our podcast. We've done things on your platform, Women of Impact, live Instagrams together. I think you are the best. You're just a force of positivity and kindness. And you are one of the rare people that I've met, especially as a woman, that is constantly cheerleading for everybody else to find their happiness and their purpose. So we are super excited to talk to you today.
I'm so honored to be on, girl. Obviously, yeah, like you said, we've got such a history, and then getting to meet your wonderful husband. I'm so excited for today.
Me too. So there's a lot I want to unpack. Guys, check out Lisa's book, Radical Confidence. I keep wanting to say kindness because I use that phrase a lot, radical kindness. So if I do that, that is why. Before we ask you any questions, I wanted to read part of your introduction. Lisa has a very colorful vocabulary. So when I read, I'm going to read her words. They are her words, not mine. What the hell is radical confidence? Radical. Turning something on its head by not giving an F. Confidence, the ability to believe in yourself even when you have insecurities, are vulnerable, or feel like total shit. And a tool that can be strengthened, developed, or when necessary, faked. So you start out the book saying, if anyone had ever sat me down and told me you'd spend 8 years of your life as a housewife, it won't be that bad. You'll just lose your confidence, lose yourself, and squash all your hopes and dreams. I would have run screaming from the room, leaving a Lisa-shaped hole in the wall. So, and then you go on, and I just want to stop there before I read some more. So you were 22 when you became a stay-at-home wife, and you imagined having four kids, finding fulfillment with that life, which, for the record, is beautiful, but it didn't seem to be the right path for you. And you also wrote about how you didn't hit rock bottom ever or have like an aha moment. So what kind of made you switch gears?
Yeah, I think it becomes over time. You know, when people say like, I blinked and, you know, so-and-so happened, or I blinked and I don't know my husband anymore. And the truth is, you never just blink. It's things that happen slowly, slowly over time that you end up choosing to ignore. And that ends up being the point where, because I didn't hit rock bottom, I just kept going. I didn't have that like, oh my God, I've got to change my life. You know, what am I going to do? And so I call it purgatory of the mundane. Life just is mundane enough. People ask you, how are you? You say, I'm fine. What's going on? I'm okay. And it's that fine and okay that ends up keeping you stuck, that ends up you not questioning your life, that then leads you to a point where you just say, I don't know what's happened to my life. I've blinked and 8 years have gone by. And so how do you get out of that? I think it goes to back to, if it took you 8 years to get into it, slowly, slowly, bit by bit, it has to be that way on the reverse, especially if you haven't had that rock bottom moment. And so that comes that questioning, that little voice in your head that starts whispering to you, that's like, I actually like this? Do I actually want to do this? And that little voice, I ignored. So what you need to do is actually start to listen to her or him. You need to just start to listen to that voice in your head. Allow it to actually speak. Because once it starts to speak, you can start to ask it questions like, am I happy? Okay, what does happiness look like to you? Instead of getting into this perpetual motion of, I should be a good Greek wife. That's what my dad told me. I should be a mother. I should fill in the blank. Once you go, what would my life look like if I didn't use the word should or shouldn't? What does my life look like if I question my beliefs of why I'm doing something? So it starts to unravel the true authenticness in yourself to actually speak. And that's really the key, is who is hiding inside? Who are you not allowing to speak? And how do you give that person a megaphone so they can actually start to voice the unhappiness? And then one other thing that so many of us do is, I'll do fill in the blank when X, Y, and Z happens. So usually it's, I'll do that when I get the confidence, when I retire, when I have enough money. So we end up putting our life on hold until the when. So the question I want to propose to you and your audience is, what happens if that when never came?
So I think, first of all, we're so aligned in so much of what we both speak about. When you're talking about your Greek family, I come from a Middle Eastern background, and it was exactly the same. You know, my father, we're three sisters, and he would say to all of us, I just want you to have a good life, marry somebody good, and be happy. Like, that was not about like education even, or career, or it just, you know, and that good wife was, you know, make dinner, raise the children, cook, clean. And so my way of rebelling against that, I guess, was I vowed I'd never marry a Middle Eastern man. I found somebody completely opposite that would never expect me to ever cook and clean and in those ways. It's just, you know, how I am. My question is, because you talk a lot about the negative voice, and I want to get into that a little bit later, but often when we change things that we put into motion, right? So you're saying 8 years you lived in that reality. I'm sure a lot of people were very comfortable with that, right? Well, when Lisa's going to change now, that something that everybody else has gotten used to, did you find opposition and pushback either from your parents or siblings or your husband? How did that, because often, and you call it radical confidence, I think it's really courageous to be able to say, okay, I'm going to make that voice of my own louder while maybe shutting out other people's opinions of why I shouldn't do X, Y, and Z. Did
you find that? You're always 1,000%. And look, you're always going to find pushback. And you actually used a very powerful word, which is comfort, right? And what I think what we do is we misunderstand comfort for happiness. It would have been more comfortable for me to be in a position. And think, when I say stay-at-home wife, by the way, I just want to give context because we're going to probably talk about this a lot. I use that as a like my reality. But what I really mean to anyone listening is living a life that you don't want. So I very much applaud women that have babies, like we need to procreate, we need the world to continue. So, it was one of the hardest jobs I ever did, but it was comfortable being in a position where I didn't have to go against the grain. I didn't have to have the opposition. I didn't have to tell my dad that, you know, I didn't want to be a wife, not a wife, but I didn't want to take care of my husband because my dad had the idea that if he had a daughter, for her to be happy, it meant she had a husband and kids. So there was absolutely going to be opposition. So I want to make sure. So I recognize I actually was more comfortable as the stay-at-home wife. I got uncomfortable when I started to chase what Lisa actually wanted. And so that's the thing I just want to urge people. You're not going to find it comfortable. It's going to be difficult. But let me tell you, if you keep going, the reward will be there. And the reward is the pursuit of happiness. The reward isn't happiness because it's never guaranteed, like success. So I go to the pursuit of happiness, to me, is more fulfilling than the comfort of doing something that doesn't fill me up. Okay, so that's the foundation. Once you recognize you're living a life that isn't your life that you've ever wanted, that you ever dreamt of, how do you make that change? Number one, you have to embrace not everybody is going to be happy about it. But the question is, are you living your life for you or for them? And I hate to say this, but I'm just a realist. When I listen to my dad, a very traditional Greek Orthodox man that says, if you don't have children, you're not going to be happy. If you marry this American man, it will never succeed. I truly understand that he really believed that based on his culture, his background, growing up in a tiny village in the mountains of Cyprus where he never saw a woman ever get an education. His belief system is that, but that's his belief system that isn't mine. Now, unfortunately, children do adopt their parents' belief systems. And when I say unfortunate, I actually understand it's a protective mechanism. But when you become an adult, I think it's important to question, do you still believe it? Okay, once you've done that work, you're going to realize that the people around you are giving you their advice based on their perspective, and now you have to live yours. But how do you then make that change? Because it is difficult. You're going to get pushback. You're going to get judgment. You're going to get people that want to make your dreams, they want to diminish your dreams. And so the question is, do you believe in your goal and your dreams enough to push past it? Number one. Number two, you absolutely can do things respectfully. So with my husband, for instance, I had spent 8 years cooking and cleaning, taking care of every single thing in the house. I'm talking about He woke up in the morning, his gym clothes were right next to him. He put on his gym clothes, he gets in the car, he drives to the gym. He comes back from the gym. The shower was nice and warm. His work clothes are next to him. He jumps in the shower. He gets changed. He goes to work. I hand him his lunch. He doesn't have to think about anything. I poured myself into being, if I was going to do it, I was going to be the best in the world. Of course, it made me profoundly unhappy. But when I started to realize I'm unhappy, once I started to realize I'm never going to have the confidence to tell my husband, so I have to build the confidence to do it, but I have to tell him. Then it became, how do I tell him? Number one is have the grace that they're going to have an opinion. Number two, understand that just because I've decided that I'm going to change, it doesn't mean that he's going to jump on board immediately. So just like any change, just like grief, there's going to be a transition period. And so I just said to him, babe, I love you more than life itself. But I don't want to cook and clean for you anymore, because you have to differentiate the two things, the affection, the love, the commitment that you've got in that relationship, and then the acts of what you do in that relationship. So I articulated that to him. I love you. I would do anything for you if it came to it. But on a day to day, I have been profoundly unhappy. And this isn't your fault. This is me who never spoke up. I never said a word. I never told you this wasn't fulfilling, but now I am. So what I'm doing is...
No, but I have to say, like, kudos and props to your husband, because I work with a lot of couples and there's usually a tug of war in that conversation. Like, I've been on that in sessions where the woman is saying exactly that. This doesn't make me happy and doesn't make me fulfilled. And he uses the... I don't want to say excuse, but my love language is receiving from you in this way. And if you don't offer it to me, then I don't feel your love, which I don't think is fair, right? So I think that maybe your relationship is also had a strong foundation as well for it to be able to shift and mold to this big change.
Yes, 1,000%. But even to that, like, I don't always think about love language as being fair or non-fair. I just go, okay, if his love language is me taking care of him, which he actually said this to me last year, so I can actually take you through these steps if you want, of like how that then came up and how we addressed it. But I think it becomes that, how do you actually handle that original discussion? A, I asked my husband for help. I think that I can only speak for my husband, he wants to feel needed and he wants to feel appreciated. And so when I said, babe, I can't do this without you. I really need your help. I'm unhappy and I would love for us to do this as a partnership, for me to seek happiness and you be that support system. And what does that look like? For me, that looks like, I don't want to cook and clean for you, but I understand that for the last 8 years I have. And so I want to give you the grace to think of it as a transition period. And so what do you need from me to support you in helping me through this transition? And so now he feels heard, he feels seen. And so I said, all right, like, how about, he said, well, how do we like wean me, quote unquote, off it, just like any other addiction? And so I said, okay, what if I cook and clean for you this week, seven days a week. And then next week I'll do it 6 days a week. And then the week after that, I'll do it 5 days a week. And so what I'll do is I'll help you wean off relying on me to cook and clean. That was number one. So he loved the fact that I was addressing the fact that it's not like you're going to have to deal with it. No, no. Again, I said, we're a team. We have to do this as a partnership. So that was number one. Then number two is like, okay, so what happens? Like, actually create a plan. Like, you do business. What happens if you run out of underwear? Because I said I wasn't really going to cook and clean. So we came up with plans of what we were going to do if I got so busy I didn't have the time to clean, to do the laundry. Because I was like, babe, I just want to do the laundry like once a month. And so one day I actually missed my once a month laundry and he didn't have clean underwear. But because I've set it all up that we're in this together, he turns around and he yells from the other room. He's like, babe, I don't have clean underwear. And I'm like, oh God, like, I'm worried, right? In that moment, I'm like, oh God, I haven't fulfilled my duty. Is it going to be upset? And he's like, so I guess I'm going to work. Come on though, bye. And he literally goes to work without underwear. Now in that moment, you know how good he felt about himself that he was supporting his wife? Because he even said, what kind of husband would I be if I put clean underwear ahead of my wife's happiness? Now, That's not to say that there wasn't issues. So bring you back to that was like over 10 years ago. Last year, he turns to me because we have radical transparency in our relationship. And it's always you need to receive that person with open arms because your assumption is they're telling you because they want to fix the problem, not that they're telling you so that you can be put on your place, right? So whenever we go to each other with problems, we always try to receive it. So he comes to me, we both interview the same guest, and it's this relationship psychologist. And because we both read her book, there was this one part about nurturing. And he turned to me and he's like, babe, I need to be honest with you. I understand. I support you. I support that you want to be this badass in entrepreneurship. And I really am there for you. But I got to be honest. I actually really miss you nurturing me. And so I said, okay, babe, what does that look like? And he says, I like the idea that you preempt my needs. And I said, because he goes, that means you've thought about with me without me having to say it. And so I just keep going, what does that mean? And he's like, well, food. Food is a thing that you used to always do. I understand why you don't. But to be honest now, because you change, right? If you're going to be in a relationship forever, your needs and your wants are going to change. So he says, I've changed. And I really do feel like I kind of want you to preempt thinking about me food-wise. And I said, okay, let's go even deeper. Do I have to cook for you or can I order Postmates? And he's like, no, just order Postmates. And I was like, do I have to plate it for you or can I literally have Postmates deliver it, text you and you go and get it? He's like, well, if you actually don't mind getting it from the front door and putting it in this spot. Now, when I go to the spot, it fills my heart up to know when I see it, it triggers my wife thought about me. I was like, great. So now we've come up with this structure that now I can provide him because of his needs, like because of his love language, right? It's I find ways in order for me to show up because he's vocalized his love language, but in a way that doesn't demean me, doesn't demean my wants, my dreams, and how I want to show up in the world. Now, look, I want to caveat all of that by saying, if you're the type of person that's important to you, I've always wanted children, let's say, and your wife, I changed the rule books. I told my husband I wanted 4 children, and then I ended up saying I didn't want any. If that's a non-negotiable for you, you need to know that, and you need to say that's important. It's a non-negotiable. And if my husband, if that was a non-negotiable for him, I think we would have separated.
Really?
And so that, yeah, because I don't think you should ever demean or diminish what's important to you and what your non-negotiables are. Now, when I got married, he never said the non-negotiable was children. But let's say my non-negotiables that I said to him is, you can never, ever cheat on me because I have zero judgment. If someone has an affair and the partner chooses to forgive them, if that's great for your relationship, I support it. But I just know myself. I will never be able to forgive him. So what I said to him is my non-negotiable is, babe, that you will never cheat on me. Now, what I mean by that is I won't even give you a second to explain. If I found out that you've had an affair or betrayed me on a Thursday at 12:05, Thursday 12:06, I've packed my bags and I'm gone. So I just want to set, and it's not a threat. I actually do it to set my partner up for success. And so that's a non-negotiable. If he ever had an affair or betrayed, I would pack my bags and I would leave like that. I wouldn't give him a chance. My second non-negotiable is physical abuse. I will never allow you to lay a hand on me. It isn't a threat because that's also the thing. You're not going in and it's like, if you cheat on me, it's like, hey, I want this relationship to actually succeed. I want to be with you for the rest of my life until I take my dying breath. In order for that to happen, let's lay out our non-negotiables. And so those were mine. But a child for my husband wasn't a non-negotiable. So we were able to talk through it. Me not being a housewife wasn't a non-negotiable for him. There were a lot of bumps along the way, so I don't want it to pretend that it was easy, but we figured it out. But if you're the person that has non-negotiables and that is one of them, I totally get that you may not end up having the love story that me and my husband have where we've now been married for 21 years.
Now, it's an interesting thing because non-negotiables, as I call myself a change junkie. I have change written on my neck and you talk a lot about change also. And as we change, whether it's fair or not, our non-negotiables can change. Not the thing like you know about infidelity, you know yourself enough that that would never fly and that's you. But things like the example, like having children, you went into the relationship wanting, he did too. I guess if he had met you, it just gets tricky depending on what changes throughout the relationship. And I often say that, you know, the difference between compromise and sacrifice. Compromise is being able to meet somebody where you can not have to take away the biggest, deepest parts of yourself while accommodating them. Sacrifice is when you bite off way more than you can chew and you have to deny yourself to make them feel whole and okay. And people get very confused in that dynamic of, you know, and I often say to couples, the time that one should lean in is when it's less important to them. If it's more important to your partner, then that's when you bend and mold versus, you know, and vice versa.
Yeah, I was going to say this story is really such an important one, which most couples don't have the emotional intelligence to do what you did, which was to say, I know that I'm changing our story. Let's work on this together, right? Usually what happens, and Monica knows this because she deals with so many couples, is that one couple goes through a life moment where they say things are going to change and they almost throw it on their partner. This is what's going to be, as opposed to what you did, which I thought was so...
Or they say, wait, this is not who I married. What do you mean? This is not what we said. Assuming that change is not going to happen. Change is the only constant. And we deny that when our ego and our feathers get ruffled.
And I think it's so important for our listeners that to understand, to really try to adapt that when you're having one of those changes to go into it with partnership, not this is the decision I've made. You know, you'll have to, you know, mold to it. Which for me, I wanted to know when did you and your husband begin developing this true, you know, you call it radical truth, not
honesty. Well, you can't,
And that real emotional knowledge of each other. Was it at the beginning?
Did your relationship friendship, start? Really, you know?
Did your relationship start like that? Did it develop over time? Was there a moment? It's just not common, right? It's not common.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you even said like emotional intelligence is that's I think a skill set that we've actually been refining over our last 23 years of being together and 21 years of our marriage. And so really, I think it started with the fact that you said this, the only constants is the change. And so when people ask me like, what's the one key to relationships? Like I used to say communication, and actually I've realized that's not true. The key to a relationship is finding somebody that also has a growth mindset like you. That means that I embrace change. I want to change. I have a partner that embraces change and wants to change. And so by that, it means that you have to keep talking about your feelings. You have to keep talking about your non-negotiables or your negotiables or your boundaries. Because no matter what, if you don't have a partner that wants to talk about that sort of thing, that wants to embrace change, if you're the one changing, you're just not going to be aligned. But if you both appreciate and respect the act of change, then no matter what problems you have, you can hopefully try to communicate through it. But you can imagine if I've got the growth mindset and I'm saying to my husband, let's come up with a plan of how we approach it, and he doesn't, and he's like, what are you talking about? I married a woman that said she was going to be a stay-at-home wife and she was going to have kids, and you made that promise, and so I'm holding you to that. He doesn't have a growth mindset. Now look, there's no right or wrong. There's no better or worse. There is just facts and whether it works for you. I cannot understand any relationship. I can't fathom any relationship succeeding if you don't have a growth mindset, because the second you hit a brick wall, the second you hit a road bump, you're not able to communicate with realness and honesty about what's happening. And then the last piece I'll just add, thank you for saying the emotional intelligence thing, but I literally, you know how I actually figured out how I was going to talk to my husband? Now it sounds like I knew what I was talking about. Back then, I had no idea. I literally sat down and said, how would I want him to talk to me through this? What language would I want him to give me? How would I want him to approach it? And it's like apologies, right? It's like everyone wants an apology when someone's done something wrong, but are you always the first person to put your hands up and apologize when you've done something wrong? It's like I always give the gift that I want. And when I talk about, you know, these sorts of hard things, it's like, I want the truth. I don't want you to BS me. I don't want you to pretend. I don't want you just to mollycoddle me for the sake of it. Like And I articulate that. And so in that has been how we have cultivated the skill of emotional intelligence.
Absolutely. We practice that as well.
So I wanted to ask, so this is 8 years into your marriage and you decide a change is coming. Maybe you can share with us and our listeners how that process went. Certainly it wasn't all uphill from there, or success from there, right?
Yeah, what was interesting is even in the change that I had said earlier, right, where I was like, am I happy? I'm not quite sure. I still didn't really speak up. It was my husband that was profoundly unhappy because he was at the time just chasing money. So he was like, I want to provide for you. At the beginning, we wanted to make movies. That's a whole other story. I went to film school. He went to film school. So that was actually how I got trapped as the stay-at-home wife in the first place. It was, I was going to stay home. I was going to support him. He was going to go out and make enough money for us to then make movies together. Now, what ended up happening is I put my dreams on hold. I put my goals on hold for the sake of the greater good. And how many people do that for their kids, for their partner, for society, for their parents, for the grandparents, for the community? Like, we often will put our dreams on hold. And so in that moment, after 8 years, I'm like, I put my dreams on hold. I'm not happy, but you're not even happy. So like, where have we gone wrong? And this isn't a plan that actually ended up working. So I pulled my husband aside and said, I don't care about money. I don't care. All I care about is my husband's happiness. This is even where I didn't even say my own. I said his happiness. And so I was like, just what do we need to do to make you happy? What change do we need to make? Just to kind of cut the story short, that ended up leading to him leaving, taking his business partners. And he came home and he's like, babe, we've got a new idea. We want to make a protein bar. Now, I was hand-making protein bars for him to take to work. The wives, for his business partners, were making protein bars to take for their husbands to work. So it was the one thing that we all wanted, but wasn't really available on the market. And so I was like, all right, sure, you want to do a protein bar? I support you. I'm the good Greek housewife, so of course I'll support you. What can I do to help? Now, what we didn't expect was that protein bar company was going to grow at 57,000%. So what that does is the wife that's helping my husband make bars with rolling pins and knives, and we're making about 2,000 bars, you know, in like 8 hours of sweat, blood and tears, and I'm shipping from my living room floor. That growth goes to me shipping my living room floor one day. A week later, I've got a bag around, you know, on my back. That a week later or 2 weeks later, I've got a pallet. Like, it's exponential growth. So because I was helping, I start and the guys were still trying to exit their other business. I was the one that everyone was turning to. Now, my house was up for collateral. That was the key. My husband comes home. I want to start this business, but babe, our house is up for collateral. So every time as this company is growing and I didn't know what I was doing, I was insecure. I didn't feel qualified and I hit a roadblock. My insecure self would normally back off. Well, Lisa, you don't want to do that because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to fail. But at that moment, my house was on the line. So every time I hit a roadblock, I ask myself, you can figure it out or you can lose your house. The choice is yours, Lisa. And so I started to say, well, I better figure it out. And in that idea of I better figure it out, I started to realize, wow, I'm actually a little competent. Oh my God, I can actually do this. And so I started to build my skill set that ended up leading to my competence that led to my confidence. So in that exponential growth, I was helping with Quest. That grew so quickly. So I went from shipping on my living room floor to 2 years later, I had 40 employees working under my department alone, and we were shipping over $80 million of revenue. So we took the company from zero to $1 billion in 5 years. And I went from a stay-at-home wife to building our entire shipping department and then our entire media department. And over that 5 year period, I went from utterly insecure to figuring it out, to building my competence, to then where you see me today, where I'm confident.
That's amazing. But it's, what's interesting is you're saying that if you didn't have over your head the fear of losing the house, you might not have had the drive to reveal the competence that was already there.
Exactly. And that's the tricky thing about fear, right? Fear can actually hold you back or it can propel you forward. And so when I realized that exactly what you're saying, I then thought, I think that's how I think about life now. Anything that I attack, that insecurity, that uncomfortableness, I pause and go, is this leading you towards your goal or away from your goal? If it leads me away from my goal, then I won't do it. If it moves me towards my goal, I go, I better figure it out. And that idea that I adopted 10 to 15 years ago, I've now implemented in every single area of my life, whether that's business, whether that's personal goals, whether that's health. It really has empowered me. Whereas before, I saw fear as the roadblock, as a thing that only pushed me backwards.
Yeah, a lot of our emotions, especially the negative ones, people try to medicate, to remove, to run away from. And those are the things, if we're paying attention to what it's trying to signal to us, it is a great motivator for change, especially fear. I do remember what I wanted to ask you before when you were talking about emotional intelligence and your husband and your relationship. We've been married 27 years. And I think that besides the emotional intelligence, our spirituality is a big part of what I think makes it work, because we take removing our ego from situations, I call it the third party in the relationship, out of the equation, so we can really see each other, hear each other, grow together. Do you both have some kind of, you know, whether it's a spirituality or a belief system or besides growth mindset, because I think that's related to believing in something greater. Do you have?
Yeah, so when I met my husband, I was very traditional Greek Orthodox. I was brought up in a Greek Orthodox church. The problem is I don't understand half of the things they say because it's all in ancient Greek. And so when I met my husband and he would question, like more he was curious about my spirituality is the best way to say it. He would ask me questions. He's like, so what? Oh, tell me, you know, how come you believe in God? And unfortunately at the time, the only answer I had is because my dad told me to. Like, I don't know, like beyond that. And so his curiosity was actually what helped me ask multiple questions. And that led me to, I actually don't know. I don't think that it's just us. I don't know what is out there. I don't know if it's aliens. I don't know if it's another life. I'm a curious person, but I also am very much like driven by facts and stats and data. And so this is part of like how I kind of almost proceed. Like I have two competing ideas in my head and I find that works for me. The two competing ideas in my head is that there's absolutely no God and there actually is a God. And so if I live my life going, I just want to be a really good person. I have curiosity. I want to show up and be the best person, best human. And if this is all that there is, I can still be on my deathbed and take my last breath and be damn proud of myself. And if this isn't all there is, then hopefully God's greeting me at the pearly gates. But I don't use my spirituality to guide me. I use it as a way to say, I don't know. And the curiosity in me gets excited. But just like I have the curiosity of, I really don't think we're the alone in the universe. And I think that, but I don't have facts, right? I don't have proof that there's aliens out there. But just from the way that I think, I can't imagine that we're the only people. And then the last thing I'll say is I really appreciate spirituality. I've seen the belief in God change people for the better. I've seen people who can fear death. And yet the understanding and belief in God actually allows them to be okay with it. And so I think it can be so beautiful. And I've also, and I don't know if this is where you're going, but I've seen the opposite, where unfortunately spirituality or religion has made people do things that I disagree with, murder and all of those sorts of things, you know, genocide. So I don't have a concrete answer. And I never want to BS anybody, but I am always curious. And so I love it when people talk about it. I have a lot of friends that are very religious and I always ask them a lot of questions. I have Muslim friends, Jewish friends, because to me, I'm just like, we're all people and we all care about each other. And if you have a belief, I want to understand your belief so I can understand you more. And I think knowledge is power. So it just helps me understand people more as well.
Beautiful. I wanted to go back to a little bit of what we were talking about before, which I know you speak about it at length in your book as well. So the fear, right, when fear comes up, because I know, I'm sure many of our listeners, you know, trying to grow, to change, to accomplish in life, you know, fear always, almost always comes in. So maybe you can share with our listeners some of the tools that you used or the understandings that you have around it, where I would assume today when fear comes in for you, it's more propelling forward rather than blocking.
Absolutely. So first of all, I think you have to identify what you're fearful of, because there's different fears. So you've got fear of rejection, fear of not fitting in, the imposter syndrome. So these are all different elements of fear that I think through. So do you want me to just like pick a fear and I can tell you how I work through it?
Sure. I think imposter syndrome, by the way, because a lot of successful people, you know, struggle with that.
Everybody's at some point.
Right.
And what was it? So you cut out
imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome. Yes. Okay. Perfect. So we all worry about fitting in. And so I just embrace that any new situation I'm going to enter, I actually have the imposter syndrome. So how do I make sure that it doesn't hold me back? So what I do is I use the idea of being the learner. So be really curious. So one of the biggest times I had the biggest imposter syndrome was really early on in my career. So I go from a stay-at-home wife to now I'm thrust into business and with my husband and his business partners. They're seasoned entrepreneurs. They've been all in business for over 10 years. So here I am sitting in this business meeting as a woman with zero experience in a boardroom with men who have a lot of experience. So you can imagine my imposter syndrome is like raging. And that caused me to not speak up. That caused me to not question anything because I didn't want to be seen because God forbid anybody saw that I was fearful. After I left that meeting, I was like, it didn't serve me. I didn't learn anything because I didn't ask questions. I was so worried about looking silly and bad that I didn't participate. And so what was the purpose of me even being in that meeting? So I go, okay, this imposter syndrome doesn't serve me. So I'm always, does it serve me? Yes or no? If it does, then you use it. If it doesn't, then you don't. And so I'm like, how can I use this to serve me? So I was like, okay, what if I just keep asking questions? What if instead of going in there really fearful, what if I go in saying, I don't know what I'm doing. So I'm going to go in there and be the learner. So what can I learn? Right? So now even just the idea, that shifting of the way that you think, now imagine I go into the room, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm not seasoned. I have no idea. Or, oh my God, I'm going to learn. The idea of being the learner pivoted everything. I then walked into those meetings going, all right, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm going to sit here with my notepad and I'm going to write down everything that I learned. And if I don't know something, I'm going to, like in school, I'm going to put my hand up and ask. You know what that ended up doing? I started to get better. I started to refine my skill. And every time I then went back into that meeting, I got that incrementally better every single time. Where it got to the point a year, 2 years later, I walked in and shredded my stuff because I understood what I was doing then. But I wouldn't have been able to do it if I wasn't able to pivot, put my ego aside in service of being the learner. And literally that is the words I use in my head to this day. When I get on stage, I am still petrified to public speak, but I still public speak. And every time I go on stage and I think, what if I mess up? I say to myself, you're going to learn something from that, Lisa.
Well, I think that's a really amazing. Because I was, you know, part of what I love about your message and your writing is your vulnerability. I think it's so important. And I also strive to do that. And it's interesting. I don't know if you have found this, but because I share every learning, every experience, how I failed, it humanizes me, which is what I want. I never want to be put on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. But it also sometimes says something interesting where people feel very comfortable to tell me like every single thought they have about me, both positive or negative, even if it's not negative today. So for instance, when I started public speaking, I was also terrified. I mean, I don't think I ate or slept the week before I had to go the first time. And I relied heavily on notes because I was approaching it from like perfectionism, which I have now kicked to the wayside.
Can I add, it was so cute to see. Not only were you, she was making for maybe, let's say an hour speech where she needed 5 pages of notes. She would write 30 pages of notes. She would underline them. She would bold them going over and over again.
It's just painful to even hear. I mean, I over-prepared. The problem was I stayed so much in my head and now I speak from my heart more passionately. But even to this day, people are like, oh, you know, when you would come out with notes and like it was somehow a flaw, you know, and now you speak, what did you do? What did you learn? And it's exactly, and that's why I'm happy we're talking about it. It's almost like they don't mean to do it, but trying to shame me into like, oh, you know, look where you were at. How did you get? It's like shocking, right? So I think it's such a beautiful thing to be able to speak vulnerably. Remember, I heard an interview once. What's the singer? He's on Howard Stern. I talk about him a lot. It will come to me, but
Billy Joel?
No. And Howard Stern was saying to him, well, you know, your voice is like an angel. It's so beautiful.
Ed Sheeran.
Ed Sheeran.
Yeah. No, and, yeah.
And he's like, please, please Google me when I was 16 or 17 and I wrote my first song and my voice is cracking. I had no pitch. Like, it was horrible. He said, I don't want any of the children to like idolize me or think that I was just born with this voice. I worked hard at it, right? And I think that that's the beautiful thing about the work you're doing, is that show up fully as yourself, flawed, in the middle of a process, crushing it, failing, all of it, because we're human and we're going to have human emotions, and we should never be ashamed not to talk about these things, because it's really to inspire everybody that they too can be whoever they want to be in their full strength and capacity.
1,000%. I think most people, and look, I used to do this as well. It's like, you see the tip of the iceberg. I get it, right? That's when you start to pay attention, but you actually don't see everything that's under, below the water. And so, you know, people always think that you were born like this. And that was actually what ended up leading me to write this book, because everybody was like, oh my God, Lisa, you're so confident. And I'm like, who are they talking to? Because it surely isn't me. Because if you heard all the negative voice, you know, the voice in my head, you wouldn't think I was confident. So that was where I was like, what is it that people are seeing where they perceive it to be confidence? And I was like, oh, they just see me keep moving forward. But it isn't confidence. I think confidence is the byproduct of taking action. It's the action piece that you got to start. And I've said this, you know, in a couple of times in this interview already, but it's like, you have to take the action then builds the competence, and the competence leads to the confidence. The confidence is like the end goal. But what people see, including myself, is I thought I needed the confidence to get started. But it's just like the gym. If you think of it like a skill set, you don't walk into the gym and say, I want to curl just like Arnold Schwarzenegger. No, Arnie has spent the last 50 years understanding the body, understanding nutrition, practicing the way that he tenses the muscle, understands how to isolate a muscle. So if you think of confidence like that, of course it's going to take time. Of course it's going to take consistency, nurturing, research, practicing.
There's a part in your book you talk about Lisa Nichols, your friend, and how she was giving a speech. And can you tell us about that? You were having a thought where you were like, wow, she's extraordinary. Why should I even try, type of thing? I can never be that. And then she said something I thought really profound.
Yeah. So it was, I see Lisa Nichols, right? And she looks confident. She's bold. She's like, she's so inspiring. And so I'm sitting in the audience going, wow, she's so amazing. I could never do that. I could never be that. Right. And so it's like, I held her up to this pedestal. And as the voice in my head is saying, oh, you could never do that, Lisa, she's so amazing, you could never do that, she turns around just as an answer to a response to a question that my husband asked, because he was interviewing her. She turns around, she's like, don't ever make me extraordinary to let yourself off the hook. Don't make me extraordinary to let yourself off the hook. And I was like, wow. And once that hit me, I realized I was comparing my beginning to her end. She'd been practicing for over 10 years. She'd been cultivating that skill. She'd been working hard at that skill. That's like literally someone that's never picked up a weight before looking at somebody like Arnold Schwarzenegger and saying, well, I could never get that body. Well, yeah, if you never pick up a weight, of course you're never going to get that body. You can't think your way to that body. So when she said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm saying I can't do it because I'm comparing myself to the fact that she showed up time and time and time again for 10 years. Well, of course I'm not better than her. And after I've done 10 years of the practice, you better believe I better be better than the person that's just getting started. And so I used that for so many years. Every time I would look at somebody else and admire them and then tell myself I couldn't do it.
Do you want to say something before I can?
No, I had a question. But
no, go ahead, because I
wanted
to ask.
No, but I wanted to go. So I know in the new paperback edition of the book, there's...
That's where I'm going.
Oh, that's where you're going.
Well, I wanted to read a little bit from that
chapter.
Okay,
so I'll let you go.
So I'm going to curse a little bit.
I love how aligned you guys are.
We are. We often don't... We never actually share where we're going to go. We pick a topic or we choose, you know, somebody we want to interview, and then we don't say anything else. And it always does actually align.
I love that.
So Lisa's going to be a little colorful again here in the new chapter.
I'm sorry. You can just skip. You want to like skip the word or beep the word.
It doesn't sound as good, to be honest, if I were to do that. So I'm going to read it as you wrote it. But so you added a chapter, right? This is make your negative voice your bitch and your BFF.
Boyfriend is the new chapter.
Okay. Well, then it's not the new chapter, but this is what I'm going to read. And then you can go into that. So negative voice, that bitch inside your head who comments on everything, who never has anything good to say and who's occasionally right. And what I really liked about this, and you give a story about Arnold Schwarzenegger as well, which is to really look at your weaknesses so you can improve them. So do you want to tell us the story? You wrote it so well, but the point that you're making is to stop self-sabotaging, which is a big thing people do, and they stay stuck there.
It's so funny because I don't know what other interview were Arnold Schwarzenegger twice. And now the fact that you brought that up, it just goes to show how aligned we are. So yeah, it's funny. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, so he wrote an autobiography because I love like reading up about the successful people and what they did in their lives in order to get there, because I don't think anyone is born just naturally gifted. And so to see where Arnie came from and his trajectory is just incredibly, whatever you believe on his political thing, whatever, right? But just looking at his career, he's done incredible things. And so there's a story that he gives about his body where he had amazing pecs and amazing arms, and he got so many compliments from them, right? It's like every time he would walk around, all the bodybuilders would admire him, but he had these really skinny legs. And so what he would do is he would wear sweatpants, right, and show off his arms because that's where he got all the confidence from. And then he realized that he was leaning into what his ego wanted, which was the compliments. And because he was leaning into where his ego wanted, he was actually ignoring and not addressing his weak spot. And so what he did in order to force himself to address his weak spots is he put these sweaters on to hide his amazing arms and pecs, and he would walk around in shorts so that he wouldn't, to your point, the self-sabotage was hide your weaknesses and show up pretending that you're all that. But what he did is he ripped that away, and he's like, in order for me to become the best bodybuilder in the world, I need to make sure that I stare nakedly at my inadequacies. And so his version of stare nakedly, because I always use that as a quote in just like whatever inadequate thing I have, I just want to stare nakedly at it, meaning I take away all excuses. So he just stared nakedly, literally, at his inadequacy of his skinny legs. And the fact that he kept seeing them every day and he wasn't getting the compliments then fueled him to make sure that he built up his legs to the point of satisfaction so that he was able to then win Mr. Olympia.
Many times, right? I mean, I love that example so much, because often our ego wants, feel good. People are giving you feedback. So we just make that part shine and focus on that. And he did the exact opposite and went against, because he wasn't feeling confident no matter what people told him, right? He was still insecure about his legs. Such a, you know.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And how many times do we do that in life? We hide our weaknesses. We hide the things that we're ashamed or embarrassed of because we don't want people to see them. And we try to highlight and spotlight the things that we're good at so that we get that validation. But you don't then build a validation within yourself. And so the key to build that validation in yourself is saying, I'm not going to listen to the outside people. I'm only going to look at myself and validate myself. And that's ended up what he did, right? It's like he looked in the mirror. He said, I'm not satisfied with these legs. And so I'm going to work my butt off in the gym so that I can be satisfied with them. And I'm going to keep staring at them until I can tell myself I am going to do the work. And then by telling yourself you're going to do the work and then actually doing the work is exactly what then brings your internal validation versus external.
Exactly.
So I want to think you write about this as well, right? The process of going from needing external validation to internal validation. Can you share with our listeners, with us, your process, right? When did you realize how much of, well, not only the life you're living, but the decisions you were making were based on external validation, and your road towards really only focusing on internal validation?
Yeah, that actually stemmed from, you know, back when I was the stay-at-home wife, and that was one thing that actually ended up keeping me there. I think that we all hold an identity, and the identity is a good, you know, a great wife, a great husband, an amazing boss, a fantastic sister, like, you know, or even if it's a job title, I'm the CFO, I'm the CMO, right? That's the identity that we hold to. The problem is when you get praised for the identity, what happens when you no longer fit that identity? What happens when that identity no longer fits you? So I was getting the validation of being the great Greek wife, right? You even said earlier, Monica, your face when I was like, I cook and I clean and I broke it down. You're like, oh my God, you did all that. I was getting so many pats on the back and validation from my dad, from my mom, from my husband, because everyone was saying, you're the most amazing wife. So the identity, I so didn't have anywhere else that I was getting validation from. I wasn't validating myself. No one else was validating me because I didn't have an external, you know, career or anything. And so where I was getting all of my validation was from my title of being a great wife. So what I realized is, A, I have to build the internal validation myself that isn't held to my identity so that I can always change what I want to do, how I want to show up, and I'm never trapping myself. And so what does that internal validation look like? It's to the individual, but to me, it was the small things. It was the things that I could rely on myself to do that didn't have to do with money, didn't have to do with anyone else being a part of it. And that was where I found the love of the gym. And so I went from, I wanted to do 50 push-ups and I couldn't even do 10. And this is years ago. I just said, okay, Lisa, either you do the push-ups today or you don't. That's not on anyone else's hands except yours. And so I got up and I did the push-ups. That's one little moment where I validate myself. I told myself I was going to do something. I made a promise to myself and I kept to it. And then, so right, and so that ended up building the building blocks that I needed to then validate myself in other areas. I didn't have the confidence to walk into that boardroom. I told myself, Lisa, all you need to do today is just walk in the door. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to voice your opinion. You don't have to ask any questions. But today, what you're going to do is you're going to walk through that door and you're going to sit in a chair. All right, I did it. The next day or 2 days later or a week later, you're going to say two words. And your words may be, thank you very much, or thank you, right? And that, because telling somebody just to do something, even when you're scared, doesn't actually help. I think if you've got profound anxiety, just saying, oh, just do it, it actually just holds them back. So I think in these tiny, little, incremental steps that become these building blocks to the house that you're trying to build of, let's say that house right now is validation. So you just do it one by one. You tell yourself you're going to do something and you do it. You tell yourself you want to go to the gym, but maybe you're too scared to walk into the gym. So maybe step one is you go on the internet and you just subscribe to a membership. Maybe step two is you go and buy yourself sneakers. Maybe step three is you drive around the parking lot of the gym that you want to go to. And then, right, you can see it builds the building blocks of I validated myself. I've told myself I was going to do something and now I do it. And now over time, you seek less and less that external opinions to make you feel good about yourself because you're doing it to yourself every day.
Right. You have a thought and then you follow it up by immediate action, no matter how big or small. It doesn't matter as long as there's movement. You actually wrote, which I thought was funny because one of the things I always think about when I think about you is the first time I met you, which is when I came to your house and you interviewed me. And I was so impressed with, I don't think I ever told you this, but I was so impressed with how you opened the interview. And you didn't say anything. You just started saying things about fear. We were talking about my book, Fear's Not an Option. And the way you said it with such confidence, I almost didn't recognize that they were my words you were reading from the opening of the book. But then when I was reading your book, you said that you, after you talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and you looked within to find where you felt your weaknesses were. And you write that part of it was, because you had a lot of fear about public speaking and starting this whole kind of path. And you say, well, I needed to create a better opening in the interviews, which is so funny because you nailed it. I mean, I never told you, but that was the thing that I always thought about when I walked out. I was like, wow, I'm really impressed. So just to your point, right? When you give thought, and then you take an action and then it's just chipping away slowly, slowly. And the next thing you know, you are fundamentally living a different life and becoming the you that you were always meant to be.
Yeah. Yes. So I know. So if we can go into the new chapter in the paperback is about, yeah, I believe your first boyfriend. It's interesting. Recently we spoke to Dr. Romani, who I think you know as well.
Oh yeah. She's a great friend. I love her.
So as I was reading the chapter, I started thinking about her. So maybe you can share with our listeners a little bit of your story and really, I guess the lessons you learned from it.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, really helping women became my purpose and my calling and my mission. And so that was partly why I wrote the book, because women would think that I was naturally confident. And I was like, you know, I wish that I had this book as my toolkit and my blueprint when I was younger. And when my publisher approached me and said, hey, we want to re-release this on paperback, is there anything that you feel like you should have included? And what I realized was, in all the work that I've been doing with women over, like, you know, the last 5 years, it really is that the thing that knocks women down the most, it's not losing a job. It unfortunately isn't, you know, a career or a house or anything like that. It really is a toxic relationship. Because going back to almost where we started, right, where it's like you never just blink, the toxicity doesn't just happen overnight. What it does is it slowly erodes your confidence, especially if, like I said, a toxic relationship, obviously not a healthy one, but a relationship in general. And if it's a great one, it can lift you up, right? It can really elevate you. It can put even more fire under your butt. But a toxic relationship can actually be like an anchor around your ankle that pulls you deep, deep into the ocean. And so when you think about that from a confidence standpoint, when you think about that of how that impacts people and how they show up, it erodes your confidence bit by bit. And so it becomes that point where you blink and 5 years later, you don't recognize who you are and you don't even know how you can get back to it. And so I very much thought I need to include the toxic relationship I had before my wonderful husband, because what if I didn't break out of that? What if I was still there? What would have happened to my life? Not just from a, you know, a career standpoint, but from a confidence standpoint, I would not be the person you see today. And it was a missed thing that I didn't quite pinpoint. And so I was like, I really need to be transparent about my ex-boyfriend, about how verbally manipulative he was to me, and how many things that I didn't do, I didn't recognize. I stayed in that relationship. I allowed certain things to happen. And eventually I got myself out of that. And what would have happened if I didn't? How many people live in that? Whether they're young or whether they've spent 50 years in a relationship where they don't know how to get out. That's the reason why I wrote that chapter, because I've never seen anything ding a person's confidence than a bad relationship.
Absolutely.
How did you find, I'm going to use the word courage again, to leave that relationship?
Yeah, that was just over time. So I was in that relationship for almost 4 years. It was very turbulent. I was 16 years old, so I didn't have any maturity to handle it whatsoever. And so the first couple of years, it was like, I just thought that's what love was. I just thought that's what a relationship was. And, you know, I opened that chapter with, no one's ever going to love you as much as I do. And that is what kept me there. I didn't believe in myself. I actually believed him. And so when he would say that, I thought, oh, maybe he's right. And so that this must be love. The jealousy, the obsessive jealousy must be love. You know, he wouldn't get this upset. He wouldn't come and stalk me. He wouldn't come and X, Y, and Z if he didn't love me. So I guess this is love. And so I believed that was love. Over time, in order for me to survive, metaphorically, because I want to make sure that I'm very aware that there are people in toxic relationships that comes very physical and that becomes life-threatening. I'm not talking about that type of abuse. So I just want to make sure that I'm very clear there. But with me, it was verbal abuse. It was keeping me where I was. And over time, the only way I could emotionally survive was to be toxic back. And that's one thing that we also don't talk about. I started to change. I started to give as good as I got because I was like, this is the only way I can survive. So I was yelling at him. I was screaming at him. I became jealous. And over time, I didn't like the person I was. And that started to really weigh on me. It's like, why am I like this? Why am I accepting this? And the big end up pivot became I went to university. And so I got out of that consistent habitual motions that we got into. I went to university. We still stayed together. But I started to see examples of what a healthy relationship looked like. I started to see examples of what it felt like for others to admire you and be kind to you, because I didn't have that. I was bullied as a young kid. I was teased for my looks. He was my first boyfriend. So of course, he was the one that I felt my validation from. But going to university, so I think it becomes proof of concept, right? Like, is your belief actually real? I believed that was what love was. But is that actually true? So once I started to widen the blinders, I started to think, maybe there is another life out there. Then I started to build my confidence. I started to go out more. I started to set boundaries more. I started to put my hand up and ask questions and not be afraid to look stupid. And so I started to build my competence and my confidence in other areas that then allowed me to start to look at my relationship for exactly what it was. And that was when I ended up making the big change. And, you know, after multiple times of him using that manipulative language where it's like, no one's ever going to love you, I ended up going, well, if this is what love looks like, I hope no one ever loves me like that again.
Bravo.
Do you know whatever happened to him?
I knew you were going to ask that question.
Well, what's funny is a week before I got married. So it's like, I come from a very small town in London where it's like everyone knows each other, uncles and aunties and friends of friends of friends. Everyone knows each other. And so a week before my wedding, he calls me. So I'm like, this isn't by accident, right? He knows my cousin. My cousin knows I'm getting married because my cousin's invited to it. So I'm like, this isn't by accident. So I was just very calm. And I was like, please don't ever call me again. I'm getting married. I don't want anything to do with you. I was very polite because there was no point in me being rude back. And I hung up. The night before my wedding, a brick gets thrown in my car window.
Oh,
but my stereo doesn't go missing.
Wow.
So in that, I only assume it's him. I had zero proof. But what was interesting enough is I went from that girl that was screaming and crying and arguing with him and never wanted to let him go to flash forward. I built my confidence. I recognize what love is. I find someone that deserves me and, you know, that I deserve. And then when I had that brick through my car window, I just laughed. He's so petty and insecure and ridiculous that he wants to spite me by trying to ruin my wedding. I'm just excited that I'm marrying the love of my life. And so that was the biggest highlight to how much I had grown, because I was able to not even emotionally care about the fact that he threw a brick through my car window. And my poor mum, by the way, stayed up to like 3 a.m. for the window people to come and replace the window. I mean, it was a whole thing, which ended up becoming one of the funny stories of my wedding. So I just, but that's as far as I know of what happened to him.
That's very funny.
I love that.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think our listeners will find a tremendous amount of wisdom from your book. And I strongly recommend all of us to read it, especially in the new paperback edition. Is it out already?
It depends when this comes out. It comes out April 30th.
Okay, so we'll wait. So get your copy.
That's amazing. Go out and get your copy.
I actually have some bonuses as well. So if they go over to radicalconfidence.com, I've got some bonuses where me and my husband actually do an exclusive coaching class for an hour where we talk about the keys to our relationship. So that comes for free. I also have 3 months free on my podcast, ad free. So you get that as well. And then I also have a workbook that partners with my book so that you can actually not just read the book, you can actually take it on and do your own work in order for you to build your confidence as well. So if that's only on pre-order though, so that's an exclusive offer. So if you go over to radicalconfidence.com, you can get it there.
And everybody go get it. Follow Lisa and her sage advice. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thank you.
Stay spiritually hungry.